Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, July 11th, 2011 at 7-11-11. I am Dr. Len Saputo. That could be your lucky day. Maybe a lucky day to go to Vegas, maybe just to go to 7-Eleven, whatever it is you get there.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And please note that our shows will also be archived on drsaputo.com. That's S-A-P-U-T-O.
You'll hear Vicky's 2020 tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we have a great show for you today that will include, when is it really important to take your medicines and when isn't it?
And lack of ethics in medical research. Are important results really being omitted from clinical trials?
And do you know some common drugs that we take all the time that are linked to cognitive impairment and even increased rates of death?
And can you trust blood pressure readings that are taken at your doctor's office? And much, much more. And plus, if you want to join in our conversation or you have questions about your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. The American Medical Association, the AMA, is trying to encourage people to take their prescription medications across the board. So let's talk about how are they misrepresenting the truth with general statements that can be dangerous.
Isn't that the truth? You know, there was an article that came out in Medicine Today, which is part of Medscape Today News, which is part of WebMD. And in this, what they had is an article talking about how important it is to take your medications. And they give a bunch of statistics that tell us that we don't take them near as much as we should. In fact, nearly 75% of Americans admit they don't always take the medications they're prescribed. About a third of the prescriptions aren't filled. And that leads to lots of problems when it comes to more hospitalizations, more people dying, and healthcare costs that skyrocket. And while that may be true for some conditions, and having had 35 years of practice in the emergency room and in the in hospitals with ICU and CCU care, I know we save a lot of patients' lives when we're in the hospital. But when you're out of the hospital, it's another story. Here, I think what we have is a kind of one-sided position that this article is taking, that's really put out there by the AMA, that's saying that we should just look at the good side of it. But the bad side of it is, did you know that if you take your medicines properly, that 400,000 people a year are going to die from them, and that we have hospitalizations that run to 2 or 3 million each year because of drug problems, that 1 in 6 people who go to the emergency room go to the emergency room because of a drug-related problem, and that it drives up health care costs to about the tune of $300 billion a year. So
they didn't include this in the study. I mean, they were saying about how not taking your medications costs $300 billion a
exactly.
year.
Exactly. So there's two sides to the story. I think what's happening is that the American public is starting to get gun-shy when it comes to trusting distinguished people like the doctor who published the article that was in WebMD. Yeah, she did get an honorarium, didn't she? And oh, by the way, she also has had a history of working for some of these organizations herself in the past. So she's got a conflict of interest that I think is something that probably led to this being presented the way that it was.
Well, you know, the article gets, you know, the headline of it gets your attention, and the article is misrepresenting the truth.
Well, it's scary.
So,
it's scaring
so
people.
When we talk about who does need prescriptions, because like we said, there are two sides to everything, and you mentioned the seriously ill. Well, people that we talk about that are seriously ill would include people that might have a serious infection, maybe somebody having an asthmatic attack.
Sure.
Or
being congestive heart failure and pulmonary edema. I mean, these are all
or a
medically
bladder infection even that could go up to the kidneys.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to use medications, but there are a lot of reasons to be very conservative. And the real problem is that we don't rely on lifestyle and natural therapies. We jump right in and start using drugs across the board, like using a sledgehammer to kill an ant sometimes.
So let's talk about maybe some of the drugs that are not necessary, you know, because they try to promote drugs that are being preventative, you know, like maybe when people have high cholesterol levels, or they want to prevent osteoporosis, or they want to encourage them to take a purple pill for acid reflux disease, and some of the off-label uses. And,
well, see, doctors are trained to alert about pharmaceutical drugs as their primary way of treating, unless they're talking about surgeries. And, of course, they kind of go together. And what we really need to do is retrain our doctors, or train them right the first time. We need to get Big Pharma out of the picture. We don't want Big Pharma as the one who's dictating what medical training is going to be like.
And it seems like the AMA is definitely supporting Big Pharma.
Well, it does to a larger extent than I'd like to say.
Well, they are in this article anyway.
Well, no question about that. And we need to get away from that. And I understand that there are financial relationships between a lot of organizations that need the money to be able to do the good things that they intend to do when they start out, but easily become dependent on the funds, and they can't bite the hand that feeds them. So you wind up with organizations like the American Cancer Society, and to a much lesser extent, even the AMA, I suspect, because money talks.
But anyway, we don't want you to just stop your medications without consulting with your healthcare practitioner. You need to do that. And you might want to check out Gary Knoll's book or Gary Knoll's movie, Death by Medicine, to reinforce some of the things that we've been talking about.
Well, one of the things that we haven't looked at that we need to take a hard look at is how much good does medicine actually do when you subtract out the problems that it creates? We know from Gary Knoll's study that there were about 1 million deaths every year at the hands of the medical profession. How many people's lives are saved? How many hospitalizations are prevented? How many people's quality of life is improved? That number has never been studied. It needs to be studied because it's really important to know the statistics before you can just say one way or the other. And what we need is doctors who are trained to be able to see through the different styles of how somebody can be managed and take a more integrative approach. We need to be able to go beyond where our training stopped and be open to new approaches that weren't in our training that might be valuable and less invasive to treat people's conditions. So things like chiropractic and acupuncture and other kinds of disciplines like that could be very safe, could be very effective, don't have the side effects and complications, is what we do in the mainstream medical practice. Now, on the other hand, it doesn't mean throw out medicine. I mean, you'd have to be a moron to do that. The stuff that we can do in medicine is definitely life-saving in some settings, and it is definitely improving quality of life. I mean, I can take my own situation as a senior tennis player. I've had 2 knee arthroscopies. Had I not had those, I can guarantee you I could hardly walk and or bend my leg out of a certain position. I got hit in the eye by a tennis ball, and 25 years later had a membrane on the back of my retina peeled off in a 3-hour procedure that was miraculous. It went from my not being able to see the E on the chart to having close to 20/20 vision. I had a hip resurfaced. I'm a mess, aren't I?
Well, you could
but
be.
I think about it, I would definitely be out of it. And you might say, well, gee, doc, maybe you're exercising a little too much. Well, you know, as you get older, if you don't exercise, you get caught into another trap.
You lose it.
That's right. And so you have to find a place that's in between where you use your common sense. I would much rather have gone through the surgeries I've had to go through because of my injuries and be in the physical condition that I'm in my senior years than I would be to have preserved those joints and been unfit, because we know that exercise does so many good things. So I'm all for using Western medicine in the right context.
Well, we believe in integrative medicine, and that's blending Western medicine with complementary alternative medicine.
Sure, it's using the high-tech approach that we have in Western medicine with the hands-on low-tech approach that we use in complementary and alternative medicine. And working together makes sense. I mean, why would somebody not want to work together? There's enough disease to go around for sure. But what we don't have is enough cures for it. And if we had all the cures, we wouldn't have the epidemic of chronic diseases that we do that's now affecting 50% of our population.
Or if we practice prevention.
Yeah, really. I mean, shifting the paradigm would be a wonderful thing, but there are a lot of major people who are interested in keeping things just the way they are, people with a lot of power, because let's face it, the medical drug industry is huge. It makes more profits than the of the Fortune 500 companies that are out there, they are the top 10.
So they make money off of people being sick?
Well, they do. But the top 10 make more money than the other 490 combined. So what would happen if we shift the paradigm? What if we moved away from drugs and technologies? You'd see an economic collapse from the point of view of loss of trade, loss of jobs, loss of business. So we Americans have as much of the rest of the world has, have a real big problem in trying to decide how we're going to move forward when it comes to our lifestyle. Are we going to depend on medicines and surgeries and expect to get sick and go to our doctor and look for some kind of magic bullet to make us better that is fraught with all kinds of complications? Or are we going to do something to take more responsibility for our health in a wellness and prevention paradigm where we stay well? Isn't that just common sense?
The number here at Prescriptions for Health, if you have any questions about your health or want to join in our conversation, is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Lack of ethics in medical research. You know, research is still getting by with lots of conflicts of interest. And some of the current studies on surgical trial to encourage bone growth and another one on the drug Neurontin are in the news for being unethical. So tell us about the important results in the clinical trials that are being omitted, like with the Medtronic trials.
Well, when doctors do research or researchers do research, doesn't have to just be doctors, they should report everything that happens, the positive things and the negative things, and they should do that fairly.
And you can lie and you can lie by omission.
Well, they do lie by omission, and in this case, we're looking at Medtronic, a company that had a product that was for bone growth. Okay, they promoted a product for bone growth in spine surgery. The surgeons, there were 15 of them, failed to report the serious complications in the research papers, and this was according to the Wall Street Journal, so we've got a pretty reliable source here. And what these serious complications included were cancer, sterility, infections, actually the reverse of bone healing, it was bone dissolution, and worsened pain in the back and leg. And this occurred in 10 to 50% of patients, so it's not like it was some little thing they neglected to publish. And then in return, those same 15 doctors collected $62 million from the company who sponsored the study.
And they just took their money and ran.
Exactly. And so what they have to do is live with themselves now, as well as all the things that they've created in terms of how much disability there's going to be because of this. And they've given doctors the wrong idea.
They're probably happy living with themselves because they got the money and they got the notoriety.
What do you think? Money alone is going to do it? Money doesn't make anybody by itself happy. If you don't have it, that's a big deal. If you do have it, it's not enough. When in my practice, I see a lot of people who have a lot of money. And in those people, amongst those people, I don't see people particularly happier than people that are poorer. It's not the money that makes a difference. It's the values. It's how they get along.
We could probably do a whole show talking about that topic.
No question, because, I mean, isn't that one of the most basic things we should be trying to figure out in our lives?
And some people, the more they have, the more they want.
Yeah, so.
And some people, it makes them tight. There are other people, look at somebody like Oprah, it made her very generous.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it makes a lot of people do the right thing.
But you can't take it with you, so.
Well, and if you just hoard it, it doesn't do anything. What we need to have is a lifestyle that gives us a return that makes us feel good about who we are and what we've contributed to other people.
Well, it makes a lot of people feel important.
Well, yes, it's an artificial thing that gives you power and status, but it isn't about power and status. It's about what you do to give, not what you receive. It's not about being narcissistic. It's about being generous. It's about sharing love. And love is about what? It's giving, not particularly in receiving, and it's giving it unconditionally. The evolutionary step this culture has to take is to move from being self-centered and narcissistic to giving and sharing and loving and communicating with people in a way that's very positive. It's about supporting one another. That would be a wonderful way to live. That would be something called community. We don't really have much of that because we have all these challenges in every segment of our culture, whether it be business, law, medicine, religion, science, sport, across the board. It's more about return on investment. It's about money. It's about things. It's about power. It's not about giving and sharing. I find it remarkable that people go to church on Sunday and they have this holy attitude and everything is wonderful and we, you know, we eat coffee and donuts together or whatever we do in church afterwards. And then we go to work on Monday and it's dog eat dog again. It's about return on investment. What can I get?
Well, and these lack of ethics in medical research. Now let's talk about these clinical trials. Actually, they're seeding trials that were done on rotten.
Well, that's right. And that's another thing that's kind of scary. What a seeding trial is when a trial is done by an advertising section of a pharmaceutical company, not the scientific research section.
So it's only to bring the name of the drug to the surface to get people to pay attention to it.
It's to get doctors and patients to see it and to become familiar with it so that they'll look at the results and take them as though they were some kind of scientific study.
So like this trial was done 15 years ago on it's Neurontin actually is an epileptic drug. That's, you know, it's also used for pain also.
It has a lot of off-label uses that the company has illegally promoted and been severely fined for, but it hasn't stopped them.
Yeah, so this study that they did was not illegal, but it was definitely unethical, and we just found out about it. And so what did we find out?
Well, we found out that there was no value to the study whatsoever. It was only to put it in front of doctors and patients, and that's what happened. And we see these studies all the time. We saw that with the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs years ago as well. So whenever we're looking at a published article, it's really important to know who paid for the study, what kinds of conflict of interest were there between the researchers and the people who were sponsoring the study, and who had what to gain from how the study turned out. And what you'll find is that in studies where there is this conflict of interest, for example, where a pharmaceutical company pays to have a study done and they pay lots of billions of dollars to have it done, they generally publish results that are positive and generally do not publish results that are negative. So what they're giving us is a skewed kind of information that tells you that you're not getting a fair look at what the real issues are and the pluses and minuses of what's going on.
Okay,
that's
so
not
it's
good
just,
science.
So it's only these seeding trials are only to promote the drugs for the doctors to see it. Just and it's not really any new information at all, but it's to increase prescriptions.
Exactly.
And so my question is if you can't trust the trial, what's the doctor have to go by?
Well, see, that's the problem. The good doctors are reading the research because they think they're supposed to. And every year we have to take a certain amount of continuing medical education units to be able to know the research and spit it back. And what we're doing is being brainwashed because we're looking at those articles that are out there, the vast majority of which have conflicts of interest and cannot be trusted. And the sad part about that is that when you're in the ICU or the CCU and you're deathly ill, the research that's been published that your doctor has fastidiously studied is going to be what he or she uses to try and treat your condition. And maybe it's the wrong stuff, not the doctor's fault, at least not directly. But now that doctors know and are becoming very much more aware of the conflicts of interest and the way research is coming out to be misleading, they're starting to doubt it too. In fact, the whole medical paradigm is shifting away from using new drugs or using drugs at all. It's a lifestyle that's wellness and prevention oriented. And that's, of course, what it should be. But it's taken us more than half a century to wake up to that.
And what people need to realize that I think we really can't emphasize enough is that the newer drugs that are promoted that everybody thinks, oh, this is going to be better, doesn't mean that they're necessarily better, because basically what they mean is if it's a new drug, we're the guinea pigs. We're the rats. It's being tested on us still. The old drugs have been around for a long time, and if there are bad side effects, we might know them by now. But with the new ones, they're still finding out.
So why do you think there are new drugs? Occasionally, it's for the right reason. It's so that what we have is a new breakthrough in healthcare, but that happens every decade or so. What we're really looking at is that a drug company's patent is expiring. And when it runs out, then they can no longer have exclusivity on being able to sell the drug for the price they want, because they're going to be competing companies that can make it now because the patents run out. And so they have to come up with a new drug that's on patent so they can again charge exorbitant prices to be able to make ends meet and to make a return on investment for their people. So that's what's happening. So we need to get away from that and move more to a direction where we've got honesty and integrity and things are easy to see. There's transparency in what happens. Anyway, we're going to be back with prescriptions for health. I want you to know that Vicki has a 2020 tip coming up. And if you would like to call us, we have lines open at 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health, give us a call. We'll be right back after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
To be a Buddhist to appreciate the logic and the beauty of some of these quotes that I'm going to share with you. The Buddha explained how to handle insults and maintain compassion. One day, Buddha was walking through a village and a very angry and rude young man came up and began insulting him. "You have no right teaching others," he shouted. "You are as stupid as everyone else. You are nothing but a fake." Well, Buddha was not upset by these insults. Instead, he asked the young man, "Tell me, if you buy a gift for somebody and that person doesn't take it, to whom does the gift belong?" Well, the man was surprised to be asked such a strange question, and he answered, "It would belong to me because I bought the gift." And the Buddha smiled and said, "That is correct." And it's exactly the same with your anger. If you become angry with me and I do not get insulted, then the anger falls back on you. You are then the only one who becomes unhappy, not me. All you have done is hurt yourself. Now, if you want to stop hurting yourself, you have to get rid of your anger and become loving instead. Now, when you hate others, you yourself become unhappy. But when you love others, everyone is happy. Well, now I have some quotes some other ones that I want to share with you, that if you're right, then there's no need to get angry. And if you're wrong, then you don't have any right to get angry. And I have a few here on patience. Patience with family is love. Patience with others is respect. Patience with self is confidence. And patience with God is faith.
That's beautiful, Vicki.
And I have some more here. Never think hard about the past. It brings tears. Don't think more about future. It brings fears. Live this moment with a smile. It brings cheers.
That's great.
And also, you know, every test in our life makes us bitter or better. Every problem comes to make us or break us. And the choice is ours, whether we become victim or victorious. And last but not least, search a beautiful heart, not a beautiful face. Beautiful things are not always good, but good things are always beautiful. Now, isn't that the truth?
And some things have both, just like you, Vicki.
Aw, thank you.
That's great wisdom. Thanks, thanks for doing that. The lines are open here on Prescriptions for Health, and the number, if you want to give us a call, is 888-874-4888.
That's 888-874-4888. Well, there are some common drugs that are linked to cognitive impairment and increased death, and they might surprise you. The topic of drug side effects is a pretty serious one, and it's in the news again. And this time we're talking about over-the-counter and prescription sleeping pills and incontinent pills, you know, like the gotta go.
Right.
And many others that we see advertised often on TV. And they can cause cognitive impairment, especially in older people. So let's talk about anticholinergic drugs. That sounds like such a big word. Maybe you can start with defining it.
Yeah, exactly. These are drugs that block the release of a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine, and one that's very important for us to maintain normal function of our brains. So if we don't have enough acetylcholine, we're in trouble. People who have Alzheimer's disease or senile dementia, okay, the early loss of being able to remember and to cognitively think clearly, have low levels of acetylcholine. And so what we do is we give them drugs that are apt to increase those levels, things like Exelon and Remodel and Aricept and Cognex. They're all drugs that block the enzymes that break down acetylcholine. So when you give those drugs, by blocking the breakdown of acetylcholine, you keep levels up a little higher, and that tends to make people do better. And so that's what we do. But a lot of the drugs that we use in medicine for a wide range of things, like Vicky was talking about, do the reverse. And what they do is they lower levels of acetylcholine, and that leads to premature acceleration of the dementia, as well as an increased risk of death. So all these drugs are important to consider. And there's something called a cumulative anticholinergic burden, which means that you total up all the anticholinergic drugs that you're taking, and then you see how much you have of an effect that's blocking levels of acetylcholine from staying where they should be.
And when you hear the names of some of these drugs, it's going to kind of scare you, because they're common drugs like Benadryl and Dramamine and Paxil, and some of the sleeping aids like Somnix and Unisom, and pain medicine like Demerol. And there are a lot of others also, like Lasix and Zantac and Coumadin, and some of the bronchodilators like Atrovent and so forth. And then when you think about what you were just saying, some of the drugs that are actually used for Alzheimer's disease, and they can cause things like confusion and agitation and, you know, make things worse. I mean, some of the other side effects of these anticholinergic drugs are a dry mouth and a throat, double vision, a fast pulse, urinary retention, sweating, death. How about death?
Yeah, well, that's
right. We can
right.
stop at death. We have other things, though.
Well, Vicky's making a point here, and that's that these are very widespread drugs that are used in medicine. And a lot of the time, doctors don't really realize that the drug that they're prescribing for their patient who may be developing Alzheimer's disease, it has this anticholinergic effect.
Especially in elderly people, because most elderly people are on several medications.
That's right.
And if the medications that they're on are making them more confused, I mean, no wonder older people get confused.
Well, that's right. There was a study done on 870 Catholics, nuns and priests, I guess. And what they found is that most of these people were on anticholinergic drugs. And when they were, there was a 50% higher risk for the development and progression of the disease. So this is not something to take lightly. It's something that's almost completely overlooked in the mainstream of medicine. I would say that most of the neurologists are aware of this, but you get into some of the other fields of medicine, these are things that we don't really know that much about. Whenever we use a drug, we have to be very careful about knowing not just the good parts about what it does, but the bad parts as well.
I think many people just block them out. They don't want to know because they want to take the medication if they're having a symptom, and that's what they want to do. Now, like, for example, Benadryl. It's known that Benadryl is good for allergies, but a lot of people also take it to go to sleep. They take it for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But is there something else that a person could take for an allergy that's not an anticholinergic?
Oh, there are a lot of things.
Like, is Atarax an anticholinergic?
Probably is, but there are many other natural approaches that you can take. And one of the things that we don't do in Western medicine generally is look at the cause of what's going on. What we're looking at is how do we block the effect. And there are many things that we can do there, because it's a very interesting and complicated topic. What you do for people with asthma or hay fever or any other kind of allergic condition, there are many natural things that don't involve the use of steroids or chemotherapies or other powerful medications. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicky. The number is 888-874-4888, and we have a call from Patricia. Hi, Patricia, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I have a problem with polycystic ovaries.
Uh-huh.
And I want to know if there are any natural remedies I could take to help combat that problem.
Well, there are natural things that you could do to deal with some of the effects of what happened. I don't know of natural remedies that will eliminate it. I mean, what you're looking at is a lot of insulin resistance at weight gain, problems with a little overproduction of testosterone, and I'm sure you're familiar with all these things.
Yes.
What are the major things that you suffer from, Patricia?
I have hair loss,
uh-huh.
nail pattern baldness.
Yeah, that's your testosterone probably.
Yes, and fatigue.
Uh-huh.
and just a lot of pain in the lower stomach and lower back pain.
Oh, and okay. Some of that may not be a polycystic ovary problem, but are you overweight?
No, I'm not.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'6".
And what do you weigh?
I weigh 135.
Oh, that's pretty good. Good for you. And have you been on any kind of special diet for this?
No, I haven't. I haven't been put on any special diets. I've just taken up upon myself to eat more fruits and vegetables, drink more water.
Yeah, good. Well, you may want to avoid carbohydrates in general, because one of the problems with PCOS is that there's insulin resistance. And when there is, the way to find out is to measure a blood sugar level and something called a fasting insulin level.
Mm-hmm.
Two good things that will give you an assessment of how profound this condition is with you. So if your insulin levels are high, which they often are when there's insulin resistance, and your blood sugar levels are a little on the high side as well, you know you have the problem. And the way to really treat this is with lifestyle, like you're saying. Lots of exercise. Do what you can to reduce stress. Make sure that you get 8 hours of sleep at night. You're going to have to need to deal with the pain. Have you had some kind of injury to your back or a problem with your back?
No, I haven't.
So you don't know why you have the pain?
I don't know.
Okay. Does the pain move anywhere?
No, it's pretty. It stays just in the lower back, but I don't always have the pain. Mm-hmm. Usually around when there's flare-ups.
Mm-hmm. Well, the main things when we're looking at PCOS are, I think, are the testosterone levels, the insulin resistance, the weight, and try to do what you can with lifestyle. The aggressive things that we tend to do with drugs in that setting, I don't think are the greatest thing, although sometimes we're using a drug called metformin for it, and you may well be on that. I don't know.
No, I've read about it, though.
Yeah, okay. That's good. So that's about all I can tell you about it, Patricia. I hope that gives you some kind of idea of other things that you might be able to do and things that you can check with your doctor to find out how advanced this is and then what to do with lifestyle management.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks for calling. You have a good
day. Take care.
Okay, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network. A little of Ella, a touch of the blues, and a voice that mellowed in the Lesotho Mountains is just how Dee Phillips from Cosmopolitan Magazine describes Seedy's voice. Tony Award nominee and winner of several top industry awards, Seedy is the first Southern African woman to win Britain's most coveted Ivor Novello Award for international achievement in musical theater. Join the continuing journey of Seedy's music from her beginnings in the African mountain kingdom of Lesotho to the international stage with a roster of world-class stars including Sting, Elton John, and Madonna. Listen to CD's Grace Notes live from New York City every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
Incisive analysis on the state of our planet from a black left perspective. Join me, Glenn Ford, and my colleague Nellie Bailey at Black Agenda Radio, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. We bring you the full scope of reality as we and our interlocutors see it every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Black Agenda Radio, the place to get oriented to the black left worldview on the Progressive Radio Network.
Host of Animal Magnet Pet Radio. You can listen live to me every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the best pet radio in America, Canada, and beyond. Hard-hitting pet issues, animal news, training tips, tricks, games, and quirky pet trivia, plus the A-list pet guests each week. Or listen anytime to past shows at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Listen to this show so you can be good to your animals.
Mike Fader here. Every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, I will expound and expand on stories, both personal and public, attempting to make the sometimes ephemeral but always essential connections between our internal landscapes and our external lives. So please join me, Mike Fader, Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point, here on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you have a question about your health, is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And we'll start out with a call. It looks like we have a call from John. So, John, are you there?
Yes, hi.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Just great. So what's happening?
I just wanted to make a comment about the use of the term side effects.
Yes.
To me, that's an erroneous term entirely. Mm-hmm. The effects of any substance are its effects in total, whether they relate to the ostensible purpose of the prescription or not. And that's my comment, and I'll just hang up and listen to your comment.
No, I'd like to hear what you'd like to call them, though.
Well, he's actually kind of told us. I think what he's saying is, look, these aren't things that are unexpected. These are things that are expected, and we call them side effects. Right? And when I say we, I mean the pharmaceutical industry has probably invented that term. And it's a euphemism, meaning they're trying to say, oh, they're just side effects. They're not real effects of the drug. And, John, you're right on the mark. This is exactly what we should be calling these things that are occurring. They are the effects of the medication, not some tangential thing. So thanks for your call.
Okay, so I'll stop saying side effects and call them effects. Yeah. I'll just call them effects. Well, you're right. Thank you.
All right, John, have a good day. All right, the lines are open. The number here is 888-874-4888. It's amazing how we use terms sometimes reflexively. We don't think about why we use those terms. It's like everybody else uses them, so we use them too.
We also hear the term adverse events.
Yeah, and we have complications, and we have contraindications and absolute contraindications. And I mean, that's information that tells you how to use a drug if you decide you want to use a drug. But John's comment about, look, these aren't things that should be classified differently from any other effect that a medication has, because this is an effect. It may be different in different people, because people have different genetic makeups and they have different environmental exposures. And for that reason, what happens to us when we take a drug will be different.
Well,
so we appreciate that, John.
Point. Yeah, thank
great
you.
Great question.
So the number here, if anybody else has a question about their health or want to join in the conversation, is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888. Do you take blood pressure medicines? Do you take your own blood pressure at home? Does your doctor or the nurse only take it once? What about in both arms? Well, making correct decisions about how to manage hypertension requires multiple measurements of blood pressure, preferably at home. And new studies show that taking it in both arms and at bedtime is the best.
Isn't that amazing? It's taken us 100 years to figure out how to take a blood pressure right. And this is another example of how we're taught something. It's taught authoritatively, so we make the assumption, it's written in the book and our professors are telling us this is what you do. And then we, without thinking, just go off and do that. And when we answer questions on exams, we get A's if we answer the way that we were told to. But in actuality, the way doctors have taken blood pressures is totally erroneous. You cannot take a blood pressure on a single occasion or even a couple of times in the doctor's office and think that you're necessarily getting a blood pressure that's accurate.
Well, everybody's heard of the white coat syndrome, meaning that when you go to the doctor's office, it makes you a little bit nervous. You might have been rushing to get there, whatever. It's called white coat syndrome. You see the doctor in the white coat and it makes your blood pressure go up.
Exactly. And that's normal. If it didn't change in that setting, I'd worry that there was something wrong with you. So you need to take the blood pressure in a setting that's more natural.
It's best if you can get your own blood pressure cuff to do it yourself at home. I mean, I know some people like to go to the drugstore once a week and take their blood pressure and that kind of thing. But
well, we're going to come back with this because there's a lot more on hypertension. How do you take it best? When should you take your pills if you take them? Do you need to take it in both arms and why? But it's time for Vicki's next 2020 tips. So you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
A phenomenon that I read about in the newspaper just last week about fried Kool-Aid.
Oh my God.
You know, now I've
fried
heard everything.
Kool-Aid.
I heard everything. The creator of this, this guy's name is Chicken Charlie. He sold 500 pounds.
That sounds right.
He sold 500 pounds of this fried Kool-Aid at the San Diego Fair. And they had his photograph in the newspaper, and he's obese, which I guess is no surprise when you hear the rest of this.
But this should be a felony, Vicki.
This guy has spent 20 years testing the limits of what can be cooked in grease and still taste good.
Oh, my God.
Now, for the fried Kool-Aid ball, he uses flour and water and Kool-Aid powder to make a batter and then he scoops it into these little balls that he plops into the hot oil. And he says he's going to put the directions in a cookbook.
So we've got white flour, we've got Kool-Aid, which is probably full of high fructose corn syrup, and we got trans fats. There it is. What other way can kill you faster if you want to die by your diet?
Well, listen. Some of his other specialties include deep-fried Klondike bars. I don't know how you deep-fry an ice cream sandwich, but anyway. Girl Scout cookies, deep-fried Twinkies, avocados.
Well, that might not be so good.
Now, here's the best one. Krispy Kreme chicken sandwich.
Oh,
yeah, that's
God.
Two deep-fried donuts with a chicken breast squashed in between them.
Oh, my
God.
Can
you believe that? No wonder the guy's fat. It's got to clog up your arteries besides. Well, anyway, the statistics of how many he sold last year says something to me for how people are not taking care of themselves. I mean, are people rebelling against doctor's orders and society pressure to eat raw fruit and vegetables?
I don't know what they're doing.
Last year, he sold 100,000 fried Klondike bars. He sold 2 million fried Oreos in the last 10 years, but the fried Kool-Aid is becoming his top seller.
Jeez.
And the Kool-Aid and sweet tarts, I read about those a few years ago. They're supposed to be extra bad for your teeth. It's not just the sugar. There's that whatever it is that's in them. I can't remember now. It's not off the top of my head.
Oh, my gosh.
But there was something that I read one time about it that it was probably what makes them sour. But it's really, really bad for your teeth. When I was a kid, I used to love to eat Kool-Aid. You probably did, too.
Yeah, we did.
You'd buy them for a penny or 2 pennies.
Yeah, in those days.
These little packets of it.
Uh-huh.
And our tongues were red all the time. And it's no wonder when I was in the third grade, I went to the dentist and I had 13 cavities.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, so what's my tip? You know, don't eat deep fried food. It's unhealthy. And fat and sugar together are the worst combination. They're especially with these unhealthy fats and the sugars and these bad oils. And also, you know, they make bad cell membranes. They increase your risk of heart disease and cancer and high blood pressure and diabetes. So
yeah, it's a recipe for disease.
I'm not recommending eating
Chicken Charlie's going to have to do his thing without us.
Kool-Aid or any of the rest of that, and certainly not to give it to your kids.
That's a great tip. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888. And we have a call from Vania. Hi, Vania, are you on the line?
Hi there. Hi, this is Vania, but that's okay.
How are you?
I'm enjoying your show.
Well,
and
thank you.
A caller mentioned side effects, and you all were talking about high blood pressure when I was holding on the line. I have I've been diagnosed with heart disease. Uh-huh. And I've been taking I've been on and off medication. I had to get rid of some of the doctors because they didn't know what they were doing. And I've worked with naturopaths, but I'm back working with my HMO person. Uh-huh. And I wanted to ask because my I looked up the side effects of the heart medication, which is Coreg.
Coreg, okay.
Right, and I was thinking that my body was just not doing right, but I'm probably having the side effects. Some are swelling, I don't have the other paper in front of me, and I've been looking at my arms, you know, and just thinking that, I'm maintaining fluid, but based on the side effects of Coreg alone, I think I'm just being affected, having the side effects.
And well, you may, because fluid retention is one of the things that beta blockers like Coreg can do. And
right.
They can also cause a lot of fatigue. But they also have some benefits, because in people who have had heart attacks, is that what your problem has been in the past, Vania?
No, I haven't had a heart attack.
Do you have arteriosclerosis in the heart with blockages in the coronary arteries?
Not that I've been told.
What kind of heart problem is it? Do you know that?
Congestive heart failure. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's one of the things that Coreg is pretty good at helping. But there are other things you can do as well. And one of the things that the medical doctors, the cardiologists, generally don't look at is how to support heart metabolism so that you can make more energy. The problem in congestive heart failure is that the body cannot make enough energy to keep the heart contracting as it should to be able to pump blood around so it backs up on the right side of the heart and you get all this swelling. So it may not be the Coreg that's causing the swelling. It may be the congestive heart failure. But the things that I usually tell my patients to add to what the cardiologist will suggest to make your heart failure less severe are things like L-carnitine and coenzyme Q10, maybe a little bit of fish oil if there's any question about any blood being thick. All those things that can support heart energy production are things that we should be doing. So I cannot give you advice, and I couldn't give anybody who calls in advice about what to do, but I can give you ideas about what you can discuss with your healthcare practitioner you can do the best that you can. I like the idea of doing what we have to do when you're in congestive heart failure, which may mean using things like Coreg or some of the diuretics like Lasix. Maybe some magnesium and potassium to offset the effects of the Lasix are sometimes life-saving.
Right.
And then there are a wide range of other drugs that can prevent some of the rhythm disturbances that occur too. But I think the best approach is to combine good nutrition with a healthy lifestyle and a minimum of drugs, but I would not change your drugs without the supervision of a good doctor. So, Vania, I hope that helps you understand what you have better.
Did you get the names of the supplements?
Oh, yes. I wrote those down. I listen to Gary pretty much every day, so I'm very familiar with
that. He knows
that.
All this stuff inside out. That's right.
Right, and I just wanted to say, because I've been dealing with this for several years, I have gone from, I do a combination of right now. Well, I've learned what supplements that could help me. I've been going through a process of elimination. What's been helping me more? So I'm doing both, and I'm doing exercise and things. Like, I'm in a good place right now.
Well, Vania, thanks for calling. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right, you have a good day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So what's the deal about taking your blood pressure in both arms?
Good point. You know, most of the time we're in a rush. We don't take blood pressures in both arms. We should be taking blood pressures in both arms. Why? Because if there's a difference of 10 or more in the blood pressure reading, 10 points or more, your risk for having a complication from hypertension, like a heart attack or a stroke, goes up substantially. It's an interesting finding. I don't think anybody knows why that's like it is, but it's an observation that we've made. So it's important to take the blood pressure at least on one or two occasions in both arms at the same time. So you've got to have two blood pressure cuffs and take them simultaneously in the left and right arm and see if those numbers are different. And you can't do it one after the other because blood pressure changes a lot just in a matter of seconds. And trying to reproduce a blood pressure that's exactly the same is not the easiest thing to do because we tend to be rushing, and from one beat to the next may make a difference of 5 or 10 points by itself.
So people that have hypertension should request that their doctor or the doctor's nurse take their blood pressure in both arms at the same time.
The other thing they could do is they could get two blood pressure cuffs that are automatic, pump them up at the same simultaneously, and see if they come out with the same number. That's the easy way to do it.
Don't you need to make sure that the blood pressure cuffs are the same?
Well,
sometimes I know that they're different. Like, I know in the office, we tell the patients to bring their own cuff in and compare it to the mercury
ones. That's right, because a lot of blood pressure cuffs are not standardized properly. Another good point. Another thing we should go back to and reinforce, because it's such an important thing, is that we really need to take blood pressures over a period of time. Not in the doctor's office, not from the nurse, not from the physician's assistant, but at home. And there, I suggest to my patients that they take their blood pressure twice a day, in the morning and at night. And they do that every day for 2 or 3 weeks.
And then to be sure to bring those readings to the office.
Well, I have them email them to me.
Oh, okay.
Because
well,
then I can see exactly what they are. They don't have to make an appointment necessarily. They can get an answer back that's timely and know if their blood pressures are being controlled the way I want them to be. So these are important things. The other thing that I do is I have them manage their own medication. I don't manage the medication myself because I don't do it as well as a patient can. And the reason for that is our blood pressures are up and down and all over the place. What happens if your blood pressure one time is 180 over 110 and another time it's 90 over 60?
You don't want to take it when it's 90 over 60.
Exactly. So if your doctor knows that your blood pressure generally has been 190 over 110, and he or she says, take this medication because it's what you need to take, there are going to be times when that's exactly the wrong thing to do, because when your blood pressure is too low and you take it, you could go into shock, which could cause a heart attack and a stroke from low blood pressure.
You know, this is something also to discuss with the elderly's caretakers, because many elderly people are in homes where they're being taken care of, and the order is to give them the blood pressure medicine. Well, mm-hmm. if they take their blood pressure and the blood pressure's low, they still give it to them.
Exactly.
So the doctor needs to write a range.
That's all right. They're called parameters. You give it for a certain number and not for another. And these are things that we do all the time. Look at the people who have diabetes. I mean, talk about a drug that's powerful. We're giving insulin to people. They have this so-called sliding scale where they take a different dose for different levels of blood sugar. Now, with hypertension, it's the same story. So why can't we do that? That's the most accurate way and the safest way to monitor blood pressure.
They also do it with your pulse for taking digitalis.
Exactly, if you've got atrial fibrillation. That's right. So there are a lot of things that we can do that involve people who are on medication regulating their own doses because it's a lot safer.
Well, now, there was also a study that just came out that said that it's good for people with high blood pressure that have to take the medication to do it at bedtime rather than in the morning.
That, in general, would be true as a rule of thumb. But, again, I would argue with that study and say, let the patient decide whether or not to take the pill. If their blood pressure happens to be low at night, don't take it. If it happens to be high in the morning, take it then. Mm-hmm. But in general, if you're not going to do that, the rule of thumb would be, yes, take it at bedtime, because in general, blood pressures go up at night.
So people that are taking blood pressure medicine really need to be taking their blood pressure before they take their medicine.
Yes, and it should be done every single time if they can. If you fall into a pattern and generally it runs at a certain level and it's fairly consistent, you might get away with taking it a lot less often. But if you want to be accurate and not get yourself in trouble, you need to take your blood pressure first. It's an experiment every time you take a drug.
So when should they be taking it in both arms at the same time?
Well, I think just at the beginning to find out if there's a difference from one arm to the other. And if there is, it becomes ever so much more important to be sure that what you're doing is that you're taking your medicine when you should for the right numbers.
So do you want to talk about pulse pressure?
That's another good point, Vicki. When we measure blood pressures, we get a top number, which is systolic, and a bottom number, which is called diastolic. So if your blood pressure is 120 over 80, the systolic is 120, the diastolic is 80, and the pulse pressure is the difference between the two. It'd be 80 subtracted from 120, which would be 40. The pulse pressure is the most accurate way of assessing whether or not blood pressure is a serious problem. Unless you're looking at wide extremes of blood pressure, so say somebody had a blood pressure of 240 over 180, I mean, that those numbers would be astronomical. So, yeah, you're right. I think looking at pulse pressure is the most valuable thing, but the next most important is systolic, and believe it or not, the least important is diastolic, the lower number, which is the reverse of what I was taught when I went to medical school at Duke.
That's when your heart's relaxing. The systolic is when it's
Well, contracting. We just made the assumption that the diastolic pressure was more important, and that was built on some kind of logic that somebody had that got printed in a textbook, and then we start following that as though that was the gospel, like we do with so many things in life, not just in medicine. All right, so what's up next, Vicki?
Well, you know, I was just thinking before we go on to another topic, something that I wanted to bring up when I was talking about that fried Kool-Aid, is that I was talking to a friend this morning when I was taking my morning walk, and she was telling me about this movie that she just saw, and she was so excited about it, called Sick, Fat, and Nearly Dead.
Oh, geez,
she says you can get it in the health food store, but basically there was an Australian guy that's about 300 pounds, and he had a challenge. He had a challenge, and this doctor, and he wanted him to go on a juice fast for 60 days. So he decided to take him up on it, and so he was just juicing and not eating anything else. And of course, the fat was melting off of him, and he started feeling really good, and he looked really good. And he decided while he was doing this, he was going to travel. So he would throw the juicer in the back, and she said it was not an advertisement for any particular type of juicer or anything. He'd throw the juicer in the back of his car and drive around and start interviewing people. And she said one of the things that stuck out in her mind was that he would interview these kids that were teenagers, and he'd say, what do you think of this? What do you think of juicing? What if you just did it like once or twice a day to be healthy? Because I just feel so good and everything. And they're like, well, I'm only 16. What does that matter to me? But, you know, a healthy lifestyle starts when you're young. It's really important to start when you're young. And it's good to get into that mindset. But, you know, this is probably why kids are eating fried Kool-Aid.
Well, we think we're indestructible. You know, there's an old Chinese proverb that says that before age 30, you cheat disease. After age 30, disease cheats you. And there's no question that lifestyle is the best medicine. We should be focusing on that as a primary way that we deal with our health challenges. What we eat, how much we exercise, how well we sleep, how much stress we have, what we weigh, and whether or not we have a meaningful purpose in our life are all factors that should determine what we do with our life, and that will keep us healthy if we respect that. We don't have to wait until we get sick. We don't have to have some kind of disease. We don't have to expect to be taking a handful of medicines by the time we're, you know, 20 or 30 years old. We don't have to have 50% of America have a chronic disease. We don't need to be spending $2.5 trillion a year and then complaining that we don't have enough money to go around. We've got all kinds of things that we can do to take responsibility ourselves for that could set the example, be the model, to be the change you want to see, and make healthcare something that is appropriate, affordable, and good. What we want to practice is good medicine, not any particular style. It doesn't need to be Western medicine or Eastern medicine or acupuncture or Ayurveda or Native American medicine. It doesn't have to be nutritional medicine. But it does take common sense, and it does take an interest on our part to take care of ourselves and take responsibility for what happens.
A lot of people think they're getting by with it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something called a wellness buffer.
Well, exactly. So that wellness buffer means what? It's the difference between perfect health and where we start to have symptoms. And when we lose that reserve wellness, we get into a situation where we start to fall apart. And when we do, it's like jumping off a cliff, because you have to lose about 45 or about 50% of your wellness before that happens. So we want to thank you for joining us today.
And remember that lifestyle is very important. And we want to remind you that we'll be back to back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and to take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.com and DrSaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Standard Time. And they will also be archived on DrSaputo.com. So tell your friends and remember that lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week. Thanks for joining us.